I went into the living room, snapped on the TV, then snapped it off again. My satellite dish got 50 or 60 different channels, and not a one of them local. There was a portable TV in the kitchen, however, and if I dipped its rabbit ears toward the lake, I'd be able to get WMTW, the ABC affiliate in Western Maine. I snatched up Roget's note, went into the kitchen, and turned on the little Sony tucked under the cabinets with the coffee maker. Good Morning America was on, but they would be breaking for the local news soon. In the meantime, I scanned the note, this time concentrating on the mode of expression rather than the message, which had taken all my attention the night before. "Hopes to return to California by private jet very soon," she had written. "Has business which can be put off no longer," she had written. "If you promise to let him rest in peace," she had written. It was a goddamn suicide note. "You knew," I said, rubbing my thumb over the raised letters of her name. "You knew when you wrote this, and probably when you were chucking rocks at me. But why?" "Custody has its responsibilities," she had written. "Don't forget he said so." But the custody business was over, right? Not even a judge that was bought and paid for could award custody to a dead man. GMA finally gave way to the local report, where Max DeVore's suicide was the leader. The TV picture was snowy, but I could see the red plush sofa Bill had mentioned and Roget Whitmore sitting on it with her hands folded composedly in her lap. I thought one of the deputies in the background was George Footman, although the snow was too heavy to be completely sure. Mr. DeVore had spoken frequently of ending his life over the last 8 months, Whitmore said. He had been very unwell. He had asked her to come out with him the previous evening, and she realized now that he had wanted to look at one final sunset. It had been a glorious one, too, she added. I could have corroborated that. I remembered the sunset very well, having almost drowned by its light. Roget was reading DeVore's statement when my phone rang again. It was Maddie, and she was crying in hard gusts. "The news," she said. "Mike, did you see? Do you know?" At first, that was all she could manage that was coherent. I told her I did know. Bill Dean had called me and that I'd caught some of it on the local news. She tried to reply and couldn't speak. Guilt, relief, horror, even hilarity. I heard all those things in her crying. I asked where Kai was. I could sympathize with how Maddie felt. Until turning on the news this morning, she'd believed old Max DeVore was her bitterest enemy. But I didn't like the idea of a 3-year-old girl watching her mom fall apart. "Out back," she managed. "She had her breakfast. Now she's having a doll picnic. Yes, good. Let it go then. All of it. Let it out." She cried for 2 minutes at least, maybe longer. I stood with the telephone pressed to my ear, sweating in the July heat, trying to be patient. "I'm going to give you one chance to save your soul," DeVore had told me. But this morning he was dead, and his soul was wherever it was. He was dead, Maddie was free, I was writing. Life should have felt wonderful, but it didn't. At last she began to get her control back. "I'm sorry. I haven't cried like that. Really, really cried since Lance died." "It's understandable, and you're allowed." "Come to lunch," she said. "Come to lunch, please, Mike. Kai's going to spend the afternoon with a friend she met at Vacation Bible School, and we can talk. I need to talk to someone. God, my head is spinning. Please say you'll come." "I'd love to, but it's a bad idea, especially with Kai gone." I gave her an edited version of my conversation with Bill Dean. She listened carefully. I thought there might be an angry outburst when I finished, but I'd forgotten one simple fact. Maddie Stanchfield DeVore had lived around here all her life. She knew how things worked. "I understand that things will heal quicker if I keep my eyes down, my mouth shut, and my knees together," she said, "and I'll do my best to go along, but diplomacy only stretches so far. That old man was trying to take my daughter away. Don't they realize that down at the goddamn general store? I realize it. I know. That's why I wanted to talk to you. What if we had an early supper on the Castle Rock Common? Same place as Friday, say 5-ish? I'd have to bring Kai. Fine, I said. Bring her. Tell her I know Hansel and Gretel by heart and am willing to share. Will you call John in Philly? Give him the details? Yes, I'll wait another hour or so. God, I'm so happy. I know that's wrong, but I'm so happy I could burst. That makes two of us. There was a pause at the other end. I heard a long, watery intake of breath. Maddie, all right? Yes, but how do you tell a 3-year-old her grandfather died? Tell her the old fuck slipped and fell headfirst into a Glad bag, I thought, then pressed the back of my hand against my mouth to stifle a spate of lunatic cackles. I don't know, but you'll have to do it as soon as she comes in. I will? Why? Because she's going to see you. She's going to see your face. I lasted exactly 2 hours in the upstairs study, and then the heat drove me out. The thermometer on the stoop read 95 degrees at 10 o'clock. I guessed it might be 5 degrees warmer on the second floor. Hoping I wasn't making a mistake, I unplugged the IBM and carried it downstairs. I was working without a shirt, and as I crossed the living room, the back of the typewriter slipped in the sweat coating my midriff, and I almost dropped the outdated son of a bitch on my toes. That made me think of my ankle, the one I'd hurt when I fell into the lake, and I set the typewriter aside to look at it. It was colorful, black and purple and reddish at the edges, but not terribly inflated. I guessed my immersion in the cool water had helped to keep the swelling down. I put the typewriter on the deck table, rummaged out an extension cord, plugged in beneath Bunter's watchful eye, and sat down facing the hazy, blue-gray surface of the lake. I waited for one of my old anxiety attacks to hit, the clenched stomach, the throbbing eyes, and worst of all, that sensation of invisible steel bands clamped around my chest, making it impossible to breathe. Nothing like that happened. The words flowed as easily down here as they had upstairs, and my naked upper body was loving the little breeze that puffed in off the lake every now and again. I forgot about Max DeVore, Maddie DeVore, Kyra DeVore. I forgot about Joan Noonan and Sarah Tidwell. I forgot about myself. For 2 hours, I was back in Florida. John Shackelford's execution was nearing. Andy Drake was racing the clock. It was the telephone that brought me back, and for once I didn't resent the interruption. If undisturbed, I might have gone on writing until I simply melted into a sweaty pile of goo on the deck. It was my brother. We talked about Mom. In Sidney's opinion, she was now short an entire roof instead of just a few shingles, and her sister Francine, who had broken her hip in June. Sid wanted to know how I was doing, and I told him I was doing all right. I'd had some problems getting going on a new book, but now seemed to be back on track. In my family, the only permissible time to discuss trouble is when it's over. And how was the Sidster? Kickin', he said, which I assumed meant just fine. Sidney has a 12-year-old, and consequently his slang is always up to date. The new accounting business was starting to take hold, although he'd been scared for a while. First I knew of it, of course. He could never thank me enough for the bridge loan I'd made him last November. I replied that it was the least I could do, which was the absolute truth, especially when I considered how much more time, both in person and on the phone, he spent with our mother than I did. "Well, I'll let you go," Sidney told me after a few more pleasantries. He never says goodbye or so long when he's on the phone. It's always, "Well, I'll let you go," as if he's been holding you hostage. "You want to keep cool up there, Mike. Weather Channel says it's going to be hotter than hell in New England all weekend. There's always the lake if things get too bad." "Hey, Sid?" "Hey, what?" Like, "I'll let you go." "Hey, what?" went back to childhood. It was sort of comforting. It was also sort of spooky. Our folks all came from Prout's Neck, right? I mean, on Daddy's side. Mom came from another world entirely, one where the men wear Lacoste polo shirts, the women always wear full slips under their dresses, and everyone knows the second verse of Dixie by heart. She had met my dad in Portland while competing in a college cheerleading event. Mater Familias came from Memphis Quality, darling, and didn't let you forget it. I guess so, he said. Yeah, but don't go asking me a lot of family tree questions, Mike. I'm still not sure what the difference is between a nephew and a cousin, and I told Joe the same thing. Did you? Everything inside me had gone very still, but I can't say I was surprised. Not by then. Uh-huh, you bet. What did she want to know? Everything I knew, which isn't much. I could have told her all about Ma's great-great-grandfather, the one who got killed by the Indians, but Joe didn't seem to care about any of her folks. When would this have been? Does it matter? It might. Okay, let's see. I think it was around the time Patrick had his appendectomy. Yeah, I'm sure it was. February of 94. It might have been March, but I'm pretty sure it was February. 6 months from the Rite Aid parking lot. Joe moving into the shadow of her own death like a woman stepping beneath the shade of an awning. Not pregnant, though, not yet. Joe making day trips to the TR. Joe asking questions, some of the sort that made people feel bad, according to Bill Dean. But she'd gone on asking just the same. Yeah, because once she got onto something, Joe was like a terrier with a rag in its jaws. Had she been asking questions of the man in the brown sport coat? Who was the man in the brown sport coat? Pat was in the hospital, sure. Dr. Alpert said he was doing fine, but when the phone rang, I jumped for it. I half expected it to be him, Alpert, saying Pat had had a relapse or something. Where in God's name did you get this sense of impending doom, Sid? I don't know, buddy, but it's there. Anyway, it's not Alpert, it's Joanna. She wants to know if we had any ancestors, 3, maybe even 4 generations back, who lived there where you are, or in one of the surrounding towns. I told her I didn't know, but you might. No, I mean. She said she didn't want to ask you because it was a surprise. Was it a surprise? A big one, I said. Daddy was a lobsterman. Bite your tongue. He was an artist, a seacoast primitive. Ma still calls him that. Sidney wasn't quite laughing. Shit. He sold lobster pot, coffee tables, and lawn puffins to the tourists when he got too rheumatic to go out on the bay and haul traps. I know that, but Ma's got her marriage edited like a movie for television. How true. Our own version of Blanche Dubois. Dad was a lobsterman in Prout's Neck. Sidney interrupted, singing the first verse of Papa Was a Rolling Stone in a horrible off-key tenor. Come on, this is serious. He had his first boat from his father, right? That's the story, Sid agreed. Jack Noonan's Lazy Betty, original owner Paul Noonan, also of Prout's. Boat took a hell of a pasting in Hurricane Donna back in 1958, the year I'd been born. And Daddy put it up for sale the next year? Yep. I don't know whatever became of it, but it was Grampy Paul's to begin with, all right. Do you remember all the lobster stew we ate when we were kids, Mikey? Seacoast meatloaf, I said, hardly thinking about it. Like most kids raised on the coast of Maine, I can't imagine ordering lobster in a restaurant. That's for flatlanders. I was thinking about Grampy Paul, who had been born in the 1890s. Paul Noonan begat Jack Noonan. Jack Noonan begat Mike and Sid Noonan, and that was really all I knew, except the Noonans had all grown up a long way from where I now stood sweating my brains out. They shit in the same pit. DeVore had gotten it wrong, that was all. When we Noonans weren't wearing polo shirts and being Memphis Quality, we were Prout's Neckers. It was unlikely that DeVore's great-grandfather and my own would have had anything to do with each other, in any case. The old Rip had been twice my age, and that meant the generations didn't match up. But if he had been totally wrong, what had Joe been on about? Mike, Sid asked, are you there? Yeah. Are you okay? You don't sound so great, I have to tell you. It's the heat, I said, not to mention your sense of impending doom. Thanks for calling, City. Thanks for being there, Big Brother. Kick in, I said. I went out to the kitchen to get a cold glass of water. As I was filling it, I heard the magnets on the fridge begin sliding around. I whirled, spilling some of the water on my bare feet and hardly noticing. I was as excited as a kid who thinks he may glimpse Santa Claus before he shoots back up the chimney. I was barely in time to see 9 plastic letters drawn into the circle from all points of the compass. Carla Dean, they spelled, but only for a second. Some presence, tremendous but unseen, shot past me. Not a hair on my head stirred, but there was still a strong sense of being buffeted, the way you're buffeted by the air of a passing express train if you're standing near the platform yellow line when the train bolts through. I cried out in surprise and groped my glass of water back onto the counter, spilling it. I no longer felt a need of cold water because the temperature in the kitchen of Sarah Laughs had dropped off the table. I blew out my breath and saw vapor, as you do on a cold day in January. One puff, maybe 2, and it was gone, but it had been there all right, and for perhaps 5 seconds the film of sweat on my body turned to what felt like a slime of ice. Carla Dean exploded outward in all directions. It was like watching an atom being smashed in a cartoon. Magnetized letters, fruits and vegetables flew off the front of the refrigerator and scattered across the kitchen. For a moment, the fury which fueled that scattering was something I could almost taste, like gunpowder. And something gave way before it, going with a sighing, rueful whisper I had heard before. Oh, Mike. Oh, Mike. It was the voice I'd caught on the dictaphone tape, and although I hadn't been sure then, I was now. It was Joe's voice. But who was the other one? Why had it scattered the letters? Carla Dean. Not Bill's wife, that was a vet. His mother? His grandmother? I walked slowly through the kitchen, collecting fridge magnets like prizes in a scavenger hunt, and sticking them back on the Kenmore by the handful. Nothing snatched them out of my hand. Nothing froze the sweat on the back of my neck. Bunter's bell didn't ring. Still, I wasn't alone, and I knew it. Carla Dean. Joe had wanted me to know. Something else hadn't. Something else had shot past me like the Wabash cannonball, trying to scatter the letters before I could read them. Joe was here. A boy who wept in the night was here, too. And what else? What else was sharing my house with me?